Good Friday. Today is June the 20th, and you're listening to My Farm. Well, mayflies are making the news today as they can be found all around the state, but the largest numbers typically this time of year found close to Lake Erie. We'll talk about why that is, their short life cycle, and how they're being managed after this message from our sponsor.
Sponsored by Seed Consultants, simply the best value in the seed industry. Learn more at seedconsultants.com.
We're going to take some time this Friday morning as we look out in the backyard and garden and actually look a little further. We're going to look up to Lake Erie and talk about mayflies. And anybody that's been up to the lake lately, whether you were up there over Father's Day weekend last weekend or have just been up there sightseeing or on a fishing trip, know this is that time of year. Mayflies are a common sight, particularly along the edge of the lake as they emerge from the water this time of the year. And it will continue through September. Now, they are harmless to humans. Actually, they're a sign of a healthy ecosystem. Now, mayflies typically emerge from the water as nymphs, which are the larvae, and then they mature into adult mayflies, which only actually live for a day or two. They emerge in swarms, often causing a temporary nuisance as they cover surfaces and accumulate in areas, especially around lights. They are attracted to lights. Mayflies in Ohio are strongly associated with Lake Erie, and their presence and abundance can be an indicator of the water quality as they require clean water to breed and thrive. Now, why mayflies are a nuisance, they are harmless to humans. They don't bite or sting. They don't hurt animals. Just more aesthetically a problem. Mayflies are an important food source for fish and birds, and their presence in the lake, as we said, is signs of a healthy environment. It's that time when we see a lot of our fish feeding on them. Sometimes it can decrease maybe how effective we are if we're up there fishing because the fish are filled up on the mayflies. Now, mayflies are attracted to light, like I mentioned, which is why they often gather around streetlights and windows. To help deter them, some municipalities will actually temporarily suspend the street lighting service during mayfly season. Residents can also turn off porch lights, or they'll use yellow bug light bulbs to reduce the attraction to them. Anybody that's been around Port Clinton or any of the towns along the lake, especially if you get up early in the morning, you'll see cars covered with them, the sides of buildings, sidewalks. It's really fascinating and maybe a little frightening to see the plague-like numbers of mayflies, but that's only a small portion, actually, of the mayfly life cycle. We mentioned after hatching, most of the mayfly life cycle consists of the various nymph forms, and at that stage, the immature mayflies dwell at the bottom of lakes, also rivers and streams. They mainly feed on algae and leaf litter until they reach the subimago stage. The immature mayflies undergo multiple molts where they are eventually transitioned into the subimago and finally to an adult or an imago stage. And after mayflies reach adulthood, they no longer eat due to their lack of functioning mouthparts. The stage is also a brief stage where the mayfly has functional wings but molts one last time. That final molt brings on the stage where mayflies swarm, mate, lay eggs, and then die. Now, as adults, the primary goal is to quickly mate before that death comes. And you'll see folks out with brooms and snow shovels just trying to clean them up, even snow brushes getting them off of their windshields on their vehicles so they can drive. Now, the piles of dead bugs are not only a nuisance and disturbing, but they can also be a little bit smelly, but they don't always go to waste. The city of Port Clinton also has set up a mayfly composting site for the insects for the residents to clean up the mess. It is interesting, if you watch the evening news out of Toledo or even Cleveland, sometimes you'll see they're even picked up on the weather radar as the swarms emerge and get so big that they are noticed or detected by that surveillance radar. Stay tuned. We'll be back with more after this message from our sponsor.
Williamson Crop Insurance, home of Decision Max. Decision Max allows you a simple solution to analyze your operation and make informed marketing and crop insurance decisions to mitigate your risks. Manage your whole operation in one place with the ability to blend counties, marketing, and insurance coverage to give a complete overview of your operation. Williamson Crop Insurance, protecting the Eastern Corn Belt since 1980. Learn more at cropcoverage.com.
Thanks, Joe. We're going to change directions now. Talk about strawberries. The work of one of USDA's longest running plant breeding programs is behind our enjoyment of fresh strawberries any time of the year. USDA's Rod Bain has more.
Enjoying strawberries this time of year, summertime, really now, anytime fruit treat, and one enjoyed in many parts of the world. Thank USDA's Strawberry Research and Breeding Program in Beltsville, Maryland for that. as research geneticist Kim Lewers explains.
The strawberry breeding program started at 1910. It was told to me, and I have not found anybody that can dispute it. It is considered the longest continuously running strawberry breeding program in the world.
And perhaps more significant to those and us who are strawberry consumers.
It has been credited for creating the strawberry industry.
While we are enjoying, say, fresh strawberries and cream or a homemade strawberry smoothie drink, Kim Lewers, by all means, tell us the story about the Beltsville program and its role in creating the strawberry industry.
What I mean by that is you can grow things in your backyard, they can grow wild in the woods, but it's not really an industry until they can be harvested and then shipped for market. And one of the problems with the early strawberries and wild strawberries, if you've ever had them, is that they're very tender. And almost as soon as you touch them, you've got juice on your fingers, which is kind of fun when you're picking wild fruit in the woods, but not so great when you want to have them ready for a store.
So the U.S. strawberry industry, in essence, began when shippable varieties were developed. That occurred in 1931, when the ARS Beltsville program created the Blakemore cultivar, the first type of strawberry easily shipped nationwide.
The majority of the strawberries were grown in the Tennessee Valley, and they were shipped to Chicago. And that was the beginning of the strawberry market and industry, at least as it has been recorded. I was not there in the 1930s.
At one point, the Blakemore variety made up 82% of the nation's strawberry crop. However, a threat in the early 1950s led to the Beltsville Strawberry Breeding Program saving the developing strawberry industry.
There was a disease that came around, and it nearly devastated the industry. And my predecessor, George Darrow, was aware of the disease.
Efforts to combat the red steel root rot disease in strawberries led to development of the Steelmaster variety in 1954.
So basically, he in advance saved a newborn industry by creating disease-resistant strawberries, and we've been focusing on that ever since.
So with that, a toast to the ARS Strawberry Breeding Program, as in raising a piece of toast with strawberry jam in salute, that is. I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
Thanks, Rod. That's what's making agricultural news on my farm. For my 102.7 WMYW, I'm Dusty Sonnenberg. You have a great day.